The Conservatives are the largest party. They don't have an overall majority at this stage. The Prime Minister called this election because she wanted certainty and stability. This doesn't seem to look like certainty and stability.
Welcome to Polling Politics. This podcast is sponsored by Ladbrokes Political Betting. Hi, I'm Joe Twyman, Director of Delta Poll.
And I'm Marie LeConte, a freelance political journalist.
And we're here at Delta Poll Towers, just down by the Oxo Tower on South Bank. Our guest this week is Tom Hamilton, former political advisor, former speechwriter for Labour, worked on the 2010, 2015 and 2017 Labour campaigns, and author of the new book with Aisha Hazarika, Punch and Judy Politics, An Insider's Guide to Prime Minister's Question Time. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
We're going to talk about your book in a minute, but first we're going to talk about the events of the last few days and the bank holiday, specifically the Irish referendum and the Italian elections. And what do they tell us about Brexit? Tom, what does the Italian election and the Irish referendum tell us about Brexit?
Very little, I would have thought. I think one of the most important things to acknowledge is that, especially around the Italian election, most people in this country, and I very much count myself among them, know very little about it. And while we could pretend that we do and come up with various theories about why they prove all my political priors to be correct, I would rather just stay on safe territory and say Italian politics is largely a closed book to me, and I hope they all do very well.
I completely agree, and actually I think that I sort of had that last year when the French elections happened, and seeing sort of everyone in the UK, and you know, finally it being a topic I knew quite well, being French, and saw everyone in the UK saying, you know, this and this and that, and it's like, you're all wrong. You're somehow all wrong on all sides about everything you're saying about France. And I have no intentions of being that person. So, yeah, you know, I just hope everyone is having a good time.
My family has a house in Italy, so I think that makes me actually more qualified to talk about the Italian elections than a lot of the people who are. But yes, I think this is all a fair judgment. What I'm interested in is the fact that inevitably, when anything happens in Europe, there's a comparison made with the UK and the Brexit referendum, and the discussion immediately turns to, well, what does this tell us about Brexit? My sense is it probably doesn't tell us very much because they're very different. The Irish referendum was very different. The Italian elections are very different. North Korea and Trump and their possible summit is very different from Brexit, and none of us tell us very much. So why don't we move on instead, then, to the excitement of Labour Live.
So just to be clear, I didn't laugh. I was just clearing my throat, you know, just about to talk about such an important topic.
It did sound a bit like a laugh, if I'm frank. Labour Live, this is the festival that the Labour Party has put together to celebrate. What is it to celebrate, Tom? Do you have any insight on this?
I think it's to celebrate Labour's unexpectedly narrow defeat last year, to celebrate how everyone is very happy with the state of the Labour Party. The list of bands I'm not sure if they make me feel my age or what, but I think, you know, we've discovered a list that means even less to me than the various candidates in the Italian election. I don't know who very many of them are. And when I look at the band list, I think it's a useful indicator for all of us who are interested in politics of how it feels to normal people when they see a list of the people in the shadow cabinet. These are not necessarily well known, but they might, well, nevertheless, be absolutely brilliant for all I know.
I'm, you know, sort of like somewhat younger, and I still, and
thanks,
so, you know,
Marie.
So I didn't mean it in that way. I was about to say, you know, I am aware of those bands, but also
as a representative, like,
it's true. It's true.
You know,
Marie.
Yeah, as the youth, we have had a chat collectively. And yet, so the Magic Numbers and Reverend and the Makers have not. I genuinely thought they'd both split up in sort of around 2009. It was a genuine surprise for me. Like, my main emotion seeing Labour Live was, oh, they're still going, which is not.
Well, people thought
the best
that about
thing.
The far left too, and it turns out that they they came back.
And of course, there is precedent for political movements at least trying to organise pop events. How could any of us forget Bepop Live during the EU referendum campaign, which Leave.eu tried on three separate occasions to launch? And it's funny you mentioned that you thought they'd split up, because I think both Bucks Fizz and Five at one stage or another were headlining BPOP life, but it turned out to just be the two most authoritarian members of Buck's Fizz that were going for it, and some Max Bygraves impersonator or something. But nothing ever came of that. And I understand that Labour Live is suffering from ticket problems as well.
It is. I think that, so they're currently, I think, offering free tickets to members if they switch to direct debit the donations to the Labour Party, which is, and I don't want to say desperate, you know, I don't want to be too mean, but it's kind of is a bit sad. And I think Unite is also giving away 1,000 tickets or something like that, which, again, not a great sign. And also, I feel like, you know, if I'd been, you know, sort of mega fan of Magic Numbers and a really hardcore Labour member and had decided to pay for my ticket of Labour Live, I'd be quite annoyed, actually, that, you know, everyone is now getting that incredible lineup for free.
Yeah, I mean, it's not the only sort of, you know, there is precedent for Labour having various bands behind it. You know, let's not forget Red Wedge, which did so much to put Neil Kinnock into Downing Street. You know, there are all sorts of musicians who've backed the Labour Party in the past. I think part of the problem was that with this one is that very few of the most famous musicians who are backing Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party want to do anything for free, which, you know, who can blame them?
And apparently, if you're under 18, you have to be accompanied by an adult when you go. So that must make for entertaining stuff. In 2 weeks' time, we've got the Lewisham East by-election. Now, it looks like Labour are pretty certain to win that. It's South London, so I don't know anything about it. Marie?
Not really. The main thing I know is that Heidi Alexander unfollowed me on Twitter the day she stopped being an MP, which I thought was weird.
And as a shout-out to our sponsor, Ladbrokes Political Betting do have a book on the Lewisham East by-election where you can bet on Labour winning, which is pretty certain, or whether the Lib Dems or the Tories will get the most votes in second place. And there are various other books as well. So do, if you get the chance, check that out. Shall we move on to your book then, Tom? Tell us about it.
That's
us
a very
about
good segue.
Speaking of things that people proved less exciting than people once imagined.
Speaking of things that I'm desperate for people to shell out money for, and who knows, maybe some of them will. But if I have to start giving them away, then I will.
So, Tom, you've written a book about PMQs. How did you come about writing this?
Well, I and my co-author Aisha Hazarika both worked on PMQs for quite a while as part of mostly for Ed Miliband's PMQ's prep team from 2010 through to 2015. I carried on for a little bit longer after that because I didn't leave my job in the Labour Party till 2016. So I worked with Harriet Harman and then Jeremy Corbyn for a little bit as well. So once that had all finished, I think we had the idea of trying to put a book together that was partly about our experiences and what it's like being part of a team like that, but also to talk to other people who've done it, politicians, prime ministers, leaders of the opposition, former and current advisers, how have different people approached it, what different tactics have been used, what's the history of it, and what's the point of it? You know, lots of people don't like it. Have they got a point?
So I'm reading the book now, and there's something I'd sort of been aware of, but I think, you know, I've kind of properly seen in the book, is just how much time, especially the Prime Minister, spends on PMQs every week. So, like, can you tell us a bit more about that? Because, you know, from what I'm getting, at least, you know, from Punch and Judy Politics, is that there's a point to PMQs that's not simply sort of, you know, the kind of the weekly fight, and that's why people spend so much time on it. But so, yeah, can you talk
to
us about that?
Yeah, so both sides do spend a lot of time. I mean, all of my first-hand experience of it is of opposition prep, because famously all the leaders I've worked for have so far failed to go on to become Prime Minister. But on the government side too, it takes up a huge amount of time. The two sides are doing slightly different jobs. So in government, the Prime Minister is making sure that she's briefed on everything that might come up, which could be absolutely anything. That's the nature of PMQs. There might be things that are more likely to come up this week than others, but, you know, a backbencher could ask you about absolutely anything. So you do need to make sure that you're briefed on everything that's going on in government. That actually gives quite a lot of power to Number 10. It was Margaret Thatcher who decided, or announced in 1979, that she was going to take all the questions at PMQs. Before that, sometimes the Prime Minister would transfer questions to the relevant minister. And it sort of looks like a brave thing to do to say that you're going to answer all the questions. But at the same time, that forces all the government departments to brief you, to tell you what's going on. So it's quite a useful tool of government accountability to the Prime Minister to make sure that that she or he knows exactly what's going on and can take action if there are things, if there's an answer that the Prime Minister is not prepared to give, but it's the right answer as it stands. That's a good way of forcing policy change and making sure that the Prime Minister is in charge. on the opposition side, you're doing a slightly different thing. You have control of the subject, so you don't need to get briefed on absolutely everything that's going on, but you do have to think quite carefully about not just which topic you want to pick, and you might pick the subject that's at the top of the news today, you might pick the subject that's most politically important to you, you might pick the subject that is quite politically important to you that you might be able to surprise the Prime Minister with, you might want to pick more than one thing. There's no right answer to that. But once you've settled down on that, what you're trying to do is construct a set of questions that has a logic to it that puts the Prime Minister on the spot and is sort of directed towards a political argument. It's not just a pub quiz or an exam. It's an attempt to move towards a political point where the basic argument at any PMQs is I'm a better candidate to be Prime Minister than you are, and the Prime Minister is trying to come back with, it's right that I'm the Prime Minister and not him or anyone else in this room. And that's ultimately what everyone is trying to get to.
Do you think it's actually worth it for both the Leader of the Opposition and the Prime Minister to spend, around a day and a half a week when the House is sitting? Is it worth spending all that time?
Well, the time really varies, actually. I think the Prime Minister probably does spend more time, or the different Prime Ministers have spent different amounts of time. Different Leaders of the Opposition John Smith used to just lock himself away in his room for not very long at all and come out with three questions and just do it. Ed Miliband, especially at the start, used to take far too long over it. And, you know, we'd be sort of cooped up from, you know, until 11 o'clock at night on a Tuesday, go home on the train, come in on the train the next morning very early and go all the way through to lunchtime. And it was all a bit exhausting. Early on in his time, Jeremy Corbyn was slightly, you know, to those of us who were veterans of the previous regime, it was quite surprising how late he was prepared to start on a Wednesday morning. It was quite refreshing in some ways. And I don't know whether now he's spending more time than he was. He's certainly improved since I was working for him, and, you know, draw your own conclusions from that. If the only point of it were to get through that half hour, then it probably would be disproportionate. But what they're also getting from that is, as I say, partly the accountability of government to the Prime Minister, partly making sure that she knows everything that's going on and can take action to fix it. It's partly about identifying where you might have a weakness. So if the time that you spend in prep means that you notice that there's a question that you can't answer effectively, that there's a problem in your government, even if the Leader of the Opposition or no other backbencher asks you about it, you've still spotted it and potentially taken action to deal with it. And actually, the same sort of thing is going on the opposition side as well, if they're using PMQs effectively. So, you know, your question selection and your question strategy is partly governed by, you know, what it is and isn't safe to ask. So, you know, if your side is divided on something, if there's a particular controversy about the topic that you'd otherwise want to ask about, then you probably can't ask about it. If you haven't got a policy on the biggest story of the day, then it's probably not the best topic to ask about, even if you'd like to. So it drives opposition policy making when it's used properly, as well as government policy making.
Of all the politicians who have taken part in PMQs, who do you think's been a particularly good performer, particularly good at it?
Well, the sort of standard answer to that, because it is the right answer, is probably both William Hague and Tony Blair, who were sort of the classic encounters in the late 90s, where Hague used PMQs to give a bit of confidence back to a Tory party that had been very well beaten in the 1997 election. You know, they didn't have a lot going for them, but they did have someone who was a pretty good debater, could think on his feet, could come up with, you know, a good telling line that wasn't just funny in its own right, but had a political point to it. And he told us about how he would, when he was trying to get a laugh, he was especially trying to get laughs from the Labour MP sitting opposite him, wanting them to nod along and go, actually, yeah, he got a point there. Tony Blair is, however he'd been characterised on the day. And that is quite, it's a useful thing in getting you through 4 years of difficult leadership. You know, Hague may not have been good at every aspect of being Leader of the Opposition, but he was very good at that. Tony Blair was pretty good at answering questions as well, and especially early on. I mean, one of the things that Prime Ministers can do when they're fairly new is they get to say either, this is a problem, you know, this problem you've identified, it is a problem, but that's because we've only just come in and we haven't had time to sort it out yet. Or it's a problem because you were running the country for the last 18 years and you made a complete mess of it. And as time goes on, you start to own more and more mistakes. You make more and more decisions, and those decisions have consequences that may not may not be what you wanted, and that gives more and more ammunition to the opposition, and that makes it difficult for, you know, when you have a prime minister coming in after a period of government, like Gordon Brown did and like Theresa May has, they don't have the same, you know, there might be some elements of a honeymoon period in the way that they that present themselves to the country, but so far as PMQs goes, they already own all the mistakes that a government made in the preceding years. And, you know, Gordon Brown wanted to change direction in some ways from Tony Blair, but any mistakes that Tony Blair had made, unless he wanted to completely repudiate them, which he pretty much didn't, you know, he still had to deal with them. So you don't get the same sort of easy learning curve as a prime minister that you do if you come in after an election win, the opposition's in disarray, they're choosing a new leader, you've got a stand-in to deal with. It's all quite easy in a way that it probably was for David Cameron, Tony Blair.
In 2002, you were a finalist at the World Universities Debating Championship, which strikes me as the kind of thing that you wouldn't make up on your LinkedIn profile that I was reading earlier. So do you think being a what is traditionally seen as a good debater, do you think that actually helps at PMQs, or could it be a hindrance? Could you be a bit too arrogant about your debating ability?
This is reminding me that I should probably change my LinkedIn profile, which has, amongst other things, the wrong job on it in terms of what I now do. But
are you saying you weren't at the World University? No, that's... Are you not a massive debater?
That's...
Are you never working for the Labour Party?
That's not my job anymore. It was... I think that was a useful preparation, because what... this is not something I expected to come in and talk about, or something that I think about a great deal. But I think one of the things about debating as a discipline, as a student, is it makes you think through how the logic of an argument works, how even if you don't necessarily know a huge amount about a topic, if we think this, then we must think that, then we must think the other, and come up with various different arguments. One of the big differences between debating as a student and being a politician is that in debating as a student, you've got to make a 5-minute speech or a 7-minute speech about something you don't know very much about. And you both have a level of ignorance and an amount of time that is not replicated in politics. So in politics, you can't get anything wrong, and you've only got a sentence or two to get your point across. So to that extent, it's quite different, but it's quite good. It's quite good preparation.
And I guess what I wanted to ask as well is that, so I think Corbyn is the one who started this, and then Theresa May is sort of doing it as well now, is effectively kind of asking questions where, you know, when you watch them in real time, they seem a bit out of place and a bit irrelevant. But actually what he's doing is, you know, busy doing his bit that will get clipped and then put on Facebook and go viral. So just to get sort of like galvanised Labour supporters, even though that question actually rarely lands in PMQs itself. So what do you make of that kind of new practice? You think, is it just PMQs evolving?
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, I find it a bit annoying because it feels a bit unambitious. I mean, the thing about that is that it gives you a degree of control, because even in a set of questions which are not particularly well written, not particularly well constructed, don't put the Prime Minister under any pressure, you can always find a moment where the Leader of the Opposition or the Prime Minister is just sort of speaking the truth to power, saying that, you know, they're running the country in the wrong way and it's all a disaster. And then you can clip that. The problem is that I think the frustration is that there's another way of getting good clips that you can use effectively on social media, that have a good chance of getting into the news, that have a good chance of making an impact. And that's to have a really good set of questions that beats the Prime Minister. And if your focus is on making sure that you have a clip that your supporters can see and share, then I think it slightly reduces your incentive to be really, really good at it. And, you know, I just think, you know, if you win, and if you really win by having a better argument than your opponent, then you get all the benefits of social media and all the other benefits of getting your message across to a wider public.
You talked about being really, really good at it. What would be the one piece of advice that you would give someone going into it for the first time?
As a Leader of the Opposition, I think it would be think about what the answers are likely to be and how you're going to deal with them. So it isn't just about the questions, it's about the rejoinders too. So you need to understand roughly what the correct policy answer is to your question. You need to understand what attacks the Prime Minister is likely to want to make of you. And then if you understand all of those things, then you can have a policy comeback, and you can have, you know, a more sort of personal political comeback to the political attack. Or if they've got a really good political attack, or if they've got a policy answer that's actually quite sound, then you can change your questions before you go in and not ask something quite so stupid.
And I guess the other thing is actually how... So how relevant do you think PMQs is to the general discourse and the public? You know, how much of it actually, yeah, I think matters to people and to the general kind of, you know, 5-year cycles or whatever. Does it only matter when it gets into the news, like, you know, that one clip that sort of makes it on the Wednesday evening? Or is it about putting issues on the agenda? Like, how much does it matter, I guess, outside the bubble?
Yeah, I think it matters more than just whether it happens to get on the news this week or not, because it's a good barometer for the professional observers of politics, you know, journalists and MPs on both sides, actually, of how good the leaders are at an important part of their job. It's not the most important part of their job, and it's not the only part of their job. But I do think that effective parliamentary performance, thinking on your feet, being able to encapsulate your argument in one or two sentences, having a witty comeback to an attack, you know, I think those things do matter, and they are things that we ought to want to see. And, you know, they are a mark of intelligence. They're not the only one, but they're quite an important one. And of course, the public isn't watching most weeks, and most weeks it doesn't even get on the news as a small clip. But I think it does filter through into how politicians are covered and how they're perceived. I think a leader who is properly good at PMQs will tend to get, you know, a better set of write-ups in general from journalists than one who's poor. I think the other point is that MPs on both sides get a sense of how good their leaders are from whether they're good at PMQs. And they generally want their leader to win, and they know when their leader is winning, and they know when their leader is not winning. And so, you know, if a prime minister is in some ways doing quite well, looks the part and so on, but is consistently getting beaten on either a particular issue or across the board by the leader of the opposition, that makes his or her job much less tenable, which is good for the opposition because it starts, you know, leadership challenges running and so on. The same goes for the other side, although to a lesser extent at the moment, because I think it's probably fair to say that Jeremy Corbyn has been less dependent on the PLP's support than probably any other Labour leader ever. But even though that's the case, there's no harm in doing your job well and getting your MPs behind you.
Now, Tom, there's already been a musical named after you running in the West End, but if you were to think about the film of your life, who would play you?
Well, it wouldn't be up to me.
I think you'd want to be in the room where it happened on making that decision, right?
Well, I mean, I'd want to be, but you know, I'm not sure that it would be the sort of room I would get into. I think it would be as far removed from my experience as the number 10 side of PMQ's prep is.
Now, of course, the reason that I ask this is that my former colleagues at YouGov have run a survey about who the British people would like to see them playing themselves in a film.
Would
of
that
their,
not just be a big crowd scene
of their lives? I don't think you're treating this with the seriousness that it so obviously deserves. Because for people aged 25 to 39, Leonardo DiCaprio comes out on top, which strikes me as a little weird. I don't know whether you'd want someone better looking or worse. Marie, who would you have playing you?
Well, that's the thing. I think the issue is that you wouldn't want, because he's going to kill me if I name him, so I won't. But a friend of mine was portrayed in quite a small role in a movie a few years ago, and they ended up hiring this incredibly attractive actor to play him. And then he did find some comments from people going, oh God, you know, went to the movie, loved it. Turns out, real bloke, ugly as shit.
Is this about Tony Blair being played by Michael Sheen? Is this your friend?
My good personal friend, Tony Blair. But yeah, but I mean, that being said, I would still just like to be played by Greta Gerwig because she's great.
I think, I think I can see Greta Gerwig. Of course, this comes off the back of Dominic Cummings supposedly being played by Benedict Cumberbatch in the Brexit film. Now, I think if you're going to do this, I think Benedict Cumberbatch would be great, but I think he has to do it in full Doctor Strange outfit. I think, including cape. The cape is essential to this. And the rest of it is just completely normal. But Dom Cummings is dressed as Doctor Strange throughout the entire film. I would enjoy that. I think the public would enjoy that. And I think that Dom Cummings would enjoy it as well.
I would go and see that. I don't think the public would necessarily enjoy it at all, but that's a separate question.
I think that's certainly something that we can test. Tom Hanks, top for people over 60, which I think is a safe option. But again, do you want someone a lot better looking than you? A lot older, younger? Because young men, 18 to 24-year-olds, said Tom Hardy. Now, Tom Hardy's 40, And, well, that doesn't strike me as a particularly sensible pick.
I'm just shocked that Tom Hanks is over 60.
He's 61.
Well, there we go.
So only just Meryl Streep got it for the women over 60s. But then, you know, why wouldn't I think I'd want Meryl Streep to play me in a film, actually.
On stilts.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks for bringing that up. For those interested, Emma Watson was number one for 18 to 24-year-old girls. She's 28. Jennifer Lawrence, who is 27, wins out for 25 to 39-year-old women. And Sandra Bullock for the 50 to 53. Another thing that I wanted to ask Tom, you have a BA, an MA and a PhD in theology.
Yeah.
So by the end of that, were you able to ascertain with absolute certainty that God existed?
No, I'm fairly sure he doesn't, but I don't want to be, you know, too negative about that. I mean, you know, it's not his fault.
Well, our friends at Pew Research have run a question asking people whether they are absolutely certain that God exists. Marie, what percentage of people in Britain do you think agree with that?
You actually gave me the answer before we recorded, so I'm going to pretend to be guessing, but sort of like be close but not too close. So I'm gonna say, let me think. 14%. What is it?
It's funny you should say that. Tom, what do you think?
I'm taking a big sort of clue from the previous answer.
Professional is nothing.
Was this how many people think that God does exist, or how many think
this is the percentage of people in Britain who have absolute certainty that God exists?
Yeah, that wouldn't be that high. So I'm going to go for 15%.
You're close, but unfortunately you're both wrong, especially you, Marie, which is a surprise because I told you earlier. The actual figure was 12%, but that's just for Britain. Which Western European country do you think it was highest? With 44%.
Western Europe,
absolute certainty, 44%.
Italy?
I would have guessed Italy.
Spain?
I would have guessed Italy or Spain. It's actually Portugal.
There you are.
And 60% of Swedes definitely do not believe in God, compared to 36% of Brits.
There we go.
World of heretics. So I hope we've added to your theological knowledge.
Yeah. I mean, it's the existence of God is largely a matter of public opinion.
I mean, that's true, isn't it? Right. Anyway, there we go. Tom, thank you very much for coming in. The book is Punch and Judy Politics, An Insider's Guide to Prime Minister's Questions, available from all good Amazons right now.
And we're actually going to be giving away one copy of Punch and Judy Politics. If you would like it, just tweet us at PollingPod what you think the best ever one-liner of PMQs was. And we will chat about it with Tom and decide and pick the best one and then be in touch.
So yeah, it does have to be a line that was actually in PMQs and not just something that you thought would be very funny. Although we might have a good laugh at that too. So thank you very much, Tom. And we will be back next week. But before we go, just a quick look at the papers. Okay, thanks very much. Bye-bye.
Sorry.
It's such a bad joke. This is a Poddo podcast produced by Nick Hilton and Joe Button, who also composed the theme tune.
For more details, go to PoddoPods, which, yes, is spelt PoddoPods.com. And for sales and advertising, email nick@poddopods.com.